Sports Physio Nation, welcome back. We got a pretty exciting podcast today. Just myself here and then Jaime. So today we're diving into jumping, all things jumping. I think you guys are going to take a lot from this podcast, whether you're a physical therapist, a strength coach, or an athlete just trying to jump higher. So Jaime, let's just dive into it, man.
Let's do it, man. I'm excited.
I'm going to start off. Your lunch doesn't smell good, man. It just smells like poison.
Yeah.
I hope it is.
It doesn't taste good, so.
All right. Well, that's a good start. Let's just start with it, man. So we know there's mechanical truths to sprinting. It's kind of just common things we're looking for, regardless of kind of body type, things like that. So what are some biomechanical truths in regards to jumping?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, so you definitely have a lot of the similar, like when we talk about sprinting, it's like positions, right? Like there's certain positions you kind of want to hit, and those might be influenced by the like type of sprinter you are. It's kind of similar with jumping. So I think like the biggest thing, and this is cool too, because like a lot of this is stuff that I wasn't really familiar with or didn't really know, and have just been kind of learning some new stuff, so it's been exciting. But 1 foot versus 2 foot jumping, I think, is like the most simple way to break it down. So if I was going to make it really simple, like 30,000 foot overview, 1 foot jumping is going to involve much faster like horizontal speed, like your incoming speed into the jump is going to be way higher. So think like Olympic, like high jump. Dudes are going to be sprinting down the runway. You're going to have way less hip and knee flexion at takeoff. And it's more about, so like mechanically, the 1 foot jumping is more about transferring that horizontal velocity into vertical. And you primarily do that through like minimal flexion. And it's almost like you're almost deflecting. So you got to get really, really stiff on that one leg. I like to picture like pole vaulting. They stick the pole in the ground and then it kind of basically like transfers that energy up to launch them up. That's how single leg jumping is. So less knee flexion, less hip flexion, higher horizontal velocity coming in. And you also, we'll talk more, but you also see certain body types that may prefer that type of jumping. 2 foot jumping is much more like muscular, like I've heard them called like force jumpers before. So these guys are kind of shorter, like more muscularly built. They will have a really aggressive penultimate step, or basically their last step into the jump. And then they're going to gather in positions of deeper, like kind of like a half squat, basically deeper hip and knee flexion, chest will come down. They're going to have bigger movements with the arms where they're really flying their arms back and they're ripping them forward. But I think like the biggest like biomechanical difference with that is the speed coming in to the jump and then the amount of like knee and hip flexion.
Cool. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense there.
And there's more like smaller things too, but I think like for general overview, that's something like just understanding the difference between 1 foot and 2 foot jumping was something kind of really cool that I learned about.
Yeah, so you talk a little bit there about different kinds of body types and jumping. So can you mentioned a couple. Can you kind of dive into a little more of these different types of jumpers you look for?
Yeah, so if someone is a basketball player or let's say like a high jumper, or maybe they are like a 200 meter, 400 meter sprinter in track and field. Maybe they do triple jump, something like that. Generally, and obviously there's exceptions to everything, but these tend to be like longer, lankier athletes that are very, very elastic. So when they're sprinting, like you'll see them sprint. They typically have like better front side mechanics and their hips are higher. They're a little bit more upright. So they're able to generate a lot of horizontal velocity coming into the jump. And then they don't jump high by bending really low and pushing. They jump high by running really fast, getting really, really stiff to deflect that energy up. So if you take someone like that, there's been some good breakdowns too. Like you can see, I like basketball because, so like in high jump in track and field, and I don't know that much about track and field, but there's no one, they all jump off 1 foot for the high jump. Nobody jumps off 2 feet anymore. But in basketball, it's cool because there are guys that are primarily like 2 foot dunkers and primarily 1 foot dunkers. So I think it's cool to look at basketball. A lot of the smaller dudes that are like shorter, more like muscle hamsters, they just look like balls of muscle. Those guys are the 2 foot jumpers because they're gonna jump high by putting a lot of force in the ground over a longer period of time. So they're gonna have longer ground contacts. And they use that longer ground contact because it gives them more time to basically push against the ground versus guys that are like a one leg jumper. So think of like, maybe like Kevin Durant would be like a good example of this, just for the body type. This is an extreme. Not everyone looks like that, but just so you guys can visualize, he's not going to bend down real, real low, squat, and then push really hard. One, biomechanically, like, he's so dang tall, that's a long ways to go. It's not efficient. He's probably not comfortable. Two, he's probably not super strong in that position. One, he just hasn't spent that much time there. But it's also difficult. And you can just look at his build. Like, the dude doesn't have, like, huge quads. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not going to be good there. So, basically, you have those, like, elastic, I would say in general, elastic jumpers tend to be more 1 foot jumpers, and more like muscle or force based athletes tend to be 2 foot jumpers. Gotcha. And then that also has some implications in how you might test them or train them, just because they're going to respond to slightly different things.
Okay, that's perfect segue. So kind of going into programming, so we got this like muscle bound and elastic. What are some like programming things that are going through your mind for these guys individually?
So in a real non-specific manner, I think the biggest difference with those is the total volume of weight room work. So for a more muscle or force-based athlete, they are going to need and they're going to handle much higher volume in the weight room. Those elastic guys, you can crush them. Like basically, you can make them worse jumpers pretty easily by doing a ton of like heavy lifting with them. Because you got to remember, it goes back to how they produce the mechanism by which they're jumping high. It makes like, and when I started learning about this, it's so obvious, but I just didn't really know or think about it. If you got a guy that is a classic 1 foot jumper and he runs really fast, gets really, really stiff off one leg and basically like deflects himself up. He's got stiff ankles, good elasticity. He can use that velocity to transmit it into vertical displacement. Doing something like a deep squat, like a heavy parallel squat. One, the biomechanics of the movement aren't similar because it's two legs. Two, you're putting him in positions of deeper hip and knee flexion where he's producing force, but that's not how he produces force in the jump. So it might even throw off their pattern with the single leg that they're already proficient with. I'm not saying you would never do it. Just in general, I think rule of thumb is you would do less with them. And they're more likely to, we said they're like taller, lankier, maybe they have really long femurs. They're less likely to be good back squatters anyways because they don't have the anthropometrics for it. Now in terms of like, so that's a general thing. In terms of more specific things, greater range of motion in the weight room with the force based guys. So they're probably going to be able to do full range squats, like parallel squats, maybe even, like Astagrass squats, things like that. And it's going to have more carryover. I also think you want to make sure you do a good dose of plyometrics with them that, have longer ground contact times. So maybe doing something like a counter movement jump. Maybe you could do like some repeat counter movement jumps, squat jumps, box jumps, things where they have adequate time on the ground to produce force. And obviously, if you're training them just to get them to jump higher, based on the like law of specificity, you want to do a lot of 2 foot jumping for them too, because that's kind of where they're going to be. And then for the more elastic athlete, if they're a 1 foot jumper, they probably do better with partial range of motion. So like quarter squats or half squats might be really good for them. One thing I have found to be really effective, I've been using with a lot of the volleyball players, is like a rack pull or a block pull or just an elevated deadlift. So something where they're deadlifting with the bar like just below their knees, because that amount of like hip and knee flexion is gonna be it's going to be closer to where they're jumping from. And it's cool too, because you can really load it up heavy. So I feel like there's a lot of carryover to like being able to just like create that stiffness there. There's also like less eccentric stress with that, because the range of motion is just shorter. These guys also do really good with like bounding variations. You also can do a lot more like top end sprinting work with them. They generally tolerate better. The shorter, and they're not always shorter, but generally shorter, more like muscle force-based athletes are typically going to be pretty good like accelerators, versus those athletes that are more like elastic. They tend to be better at top speed. So I think how I'm looking at it and kind of what I've learned is, I think you want to really feed their strength. Like, I'm not saying you shouldn't ever do acceleration with a 1 foot jumper, someone that's more elastic. I just think you touch it, you give them a little bit, but that's not their bread and butter. Like, you want to feed them the top speed work. And it kind of makes sense too, like, duh, they need the top speed because like they have like a long run up. Like when they're doing like a high jump, for example, you have a long runway to reach top speed. So those are kind of some of the general like programming stuff that's maybe a little bit different between them.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think it's cool to make those connections when you see an athlete, like, hey, this is kind of the body type, this is kind of the programming or movements that I think their bodies are, one's going to feel good for their body, but two, movements that are specific enough to the movement too. Because I'm sure, you know, depending on the spectrum of where this athlete is, if they're just getting started, you know, a lot of different movements are going to improve their performance. But once you get really, obviously, higher level, you got to be as specific as possible to make that change.
Totally. And it just depends, again, too. And this is something that I think I've gotten really wrong in the past. And my mindset's evolved a lot in the last, like, I don't know, 6 months or so. But it depends what your goal is too, right? Like, if you're training a volleyball player, and maybe like your goal is to just get her to be more healthy and like move better, all those things, like maybe I would argue that there is a good case, like maybe you shouldn't and maybe you won't be like really specific to the movements. But if you're training her to like, if her goal is to jump higher, she's an outside hitter and she got to do her approach jump, I do think, like, this is where I think I've messed up in the past, like you got to get specific to that movement, especially like you said, like the better they are, they've already had those adaptations. Like if people are already pretty strong, they already move pretty well, they've already done some plyometrics, it's like you can't just do anything and expect there to be an adaptation. I think that's kind of really cool. And I think too, like another note that I've changed a lot, and I think something I did wrong in the past, is I've gotten really away from like, I'm really into finding what the athlete's good at and then giving them that. Because I think in the past, like I've had athletes, I struggled to keep them healthy. Like the training, they were always getting hurt, or like I was doing a lot of trying to put a square peg into a round hole. Like I had my model, especially for me too, like my bias, like I'm not real tall. Like I'm way towards the muscle, like force based side of the things, that big like strength background, all that. So some of the things that work really well for me, or I've had good success with, aren't going to work with a body type that's different, or someone that produces force. So I think, and this goes back to kind of, I think like Joel Smith is the guy that really like opened my eyes to this a lot. Find what that athlete's good at, feed that to them. And the second thing too that I've noticed is like you get such good buy-in, because it's fun for the athlete too then, right? Like if they're constantly doing something they suck at, they feel like they can't succeed, they can't do something well. Mm-hmm. But if you give them some dosing of some things they can really get after it, mm-hmm. they like it, and then you've got that buy-in, and now it's like, hey, let's do a little bit of the stuff we suck at, mm-hmm. but we're gonna make our living on the stuff that we're good at.
Yeah. And since you brought that up, just like a motivating factor for the athlete or patient, I see you do a lot of you measure so much of the movements that are going on in the clinic, and that totally, for an athlete who's already competitive, you take measurements, whether different tests that you do, that's going to motivate them so much more than just like, hey, do this jump as high as you can.
Totally. And it's funny too, because like we did a little case study. So I was doing an assessment with a volleyball player, and she was doing an approach jump. She'd kind of do a four-step approach into it. For those of you guys that aren't familiar with it, basically they kind of get to run into the jump and then they're jumping. So it's like a volleyball player, how their footwork they would do coming up to the net to hit. And I just had her jump, okay? And I was measuring her, and she jumped, I don't remember how high it was, like she jumped 15 inches or whatever it was. And I was like, all right, come on, like give me really good effort here, you know? Because first thing is the arousal, like how like actually excited to do it are they? And she jumped maybe like 16 inches, a little bit higher. Then what I did in the clinic was I stood on a treatment table and held a little stick up. So she had like a goal to touch. And she jumped, like, I think she jumped 20 inches. Like, she jumped significantly higher. Or maybe it was, like, 18. But it was significantly higher that she jumped just from having that kind of, like, measurable, like, feedback and goal. So the point I'm making with that is, like, if you're regularly, like, assessing and testing this stuff, it's super, like, athletes by nature are really competitive. And, like, they don't understand. They don't have coach's eye or therapist's eye, right, where they can, like, they're like, oh, my movement and quality is improving week to week. Or like, oh, I'm moving that bar with more proficiency and more speed. Like sometimes they feel it, but a lot of times they don't. But they know, especially if that's their sports skill, and they're like jumping, and all of a sudden they're like, wow, I feel like, you heard it with some of the girls we've been working with here. They'll say things like, I feel really bouncy. Mm-hmm. Or another one is like, man, I feel like I'm floating in the air forever. Mm-hmm. So that's like, that's them in athlete language telling you like, stuff's working. Like they're feeling it. And once you get a taste of that, of that success, and it's like, oh wow, all that hard work I'm putting in is having carryover. Mm-hmm. Now it's like they just want to work more. So yeah. I think the measurement, like, I don't think it matters a ton what you objectively measure, but doing some objective measurement is really important.
Dude, that's so big, because I can like hit the books and try to find the best ways to get people better, but if I don't get that buy-in and they're not sold on it, man, then they're just not going to do the program. So that's huge.
Totally. And I think one thing that I've made a mistake in the past too is like, you got to use, sometimes I'll be like, we're learning about these like new assessments, or I'm like, I'm trying to do all this stuff, but the assessment doesn't really have that much value until you've done a bunch of them. So find, I think this for therapists or coaches, like find your core battery. Like, I think we're going to talk about it. Like when it comes to jump testing, like there's a whole, like there's so many tests you can do. But for me, like I've found a kind of good, like there's like kind of a sequence of like five jumps that I do that I've, because I've been doing them consistently now, I'm pretty familiar. I have a database to see like, okay, this is what I normally see with this. If I see this, this means that. So don't get like, whatever you're doing, like keep some thread of it consistent so you can get good value. Because we've talked about that too, like with the like force velocity profiling and stuff, like the first time you do it, it's not necessarily, it's almost like you got to do it and not really know what to do with the data for a few times before you get to the point where it's like, okay, now I kind of know what to do with this. You got to suck at it before you can be good at it, I guess, is kind of what I've realized.
Talking about those tests, those five tests or whatever you like to do, what are some things you like to measure?
So, and I'm going to speak specific to, like I've been, we've talked about, I've been working with a lot of the volleyball players right now. So for them, like most of them are outside hitters. So they're like approach jump, they're coming up to the net, jumping and being able to spike it is the most like sport specific thing to them. So that's what we ultimately, that number needs to go up essentially. So I will test that. I'll use their, and I've been using the My Jump app. I had the G Flight, which is kind of like a little laser deal, and that works good. But the My Jump app on your phone, it just uses your slow motion phone. I've done it right next to the G Flight, and it's like, I mean, it's down to like the tenth of an inch accuracy. I've seen like really good like accuracy and repeatability with it. So I've pretty much gone exclusively to using that. But basically, you just video the athlete doing the jump, and then it uses their flight time, and you just kind of frame by frame throw on the slow motion to get that. It works really good. So that's a little plug for that app. I think it's like $10. But I'll do their approach jump. Then I'll do a counter movement jump with arms. So this is like a standing vertical test. So this is what most athletes are maybe most familiar with. You're going to stand on 2 feet, one place, rip your arms down, rip them up, jump as high as you can. Then I'll do a counter movement jump with no arms. So their hands are on their hips, but they can dip down really quick and they'll jump. Then I'll do a squat jump with their hands on their hips. So now they got to drop down. So I'll say down. Athletes got to pause because we're trying to eliminate the stretch shortening cycle. Then I'll say jump, and then they're going to jump as high as they can on that. And then I'll do, I like to do the RSI testing. So the RSI is basically, you can have the athlete jump off of a box. They hit the ground and they immediately try to jump up as high as they can. And then the RSI is a ratio of flight time over ground contact time, or there's, depending on what you're using, it could also be jump height over ground contact time. And it basically gives you a good ratio, that number. So the higher the number is better, like over 3.0 on that is really good. And that tells you how good the athlete is at like maintaining stiffness. Like, can they get off the ground really quick? Because you can have some athletes, like someone like myself, maybe let's say, who's a 2 foot jumper, more force based. I might do pretty good in a squat jump, and then not as good in the RSI, because the RSI isn't going to be a ton of hip and knee flexion. It's more about the speed. And I think that one has like a ton of, it's really interesting to see with the volleyball players. Like I have one girl who's a setter, so she doesn't jump out of a big approach jump. She normally jumps really quick. It's not so much the height for her, it's the speed. And her RSI was like the highest I've tested. First, I have another girl that's an outside hitter who like she jumps out the gym, but her RSI wasn't quite as good. So it just, again, it gives you a little insight into not just how high is the athlete jumping, but how and why are they jumping that way. So those are kind of the ones that I'll do as a baseline. And then with that, I've been doing the force velocity profiling. So that's basically the squat jump with no additional load, so just body weight, and then like 20%, 40%, 60%. And then that just tells me whether the athlete needs more like force or velocity in terms of their training.
Gotcha. So in regards to the force velocity, we talked a lot about this in the past too, but just a quick, just touching on it with specific to jumpers. Let's say you get, well, first, what have you kind of, has there been a pattern to these volleyball players? Are they mostly force, mostly velocity deficit?
All of them have been force deficient. Now these are all high school volleyball players, so I don't know, like if I had elite level, like adult volleyball players, maybe it stands to reason to me that they'd be stronger. Maybe they have more training age, like especially for the average, like high school female volleyball player. And these are all females that I've been working with. They don't really have like a systemized strength and conditioning program in high school. Or if they do, it's not very consistent. Like, so their training age is very low. So what I've seen with them is they've all been force deficient. And I've been doing the squat jump versus force velocity profile versus like a counter movement jump. I'm suspicious that using the squat jump makes it more likely that you will present as force deficient, but I haven't done the testing with the, I haven't done the force velocity profiling with the counter movement jump enough. I need to do that. That's kind of the next step to see, to confirm if that's true or not.
Gotcha. One thing that's come to my mind with the programming. So how do you balance it? Cause I've had some people, you know, you start throwing some jumping, they start getting some knee pain. How do you like to program this jumping plyometric stuff included in with like the strength based stuff too, where you're minimizing the amount of stress on this knee?
That's a tough one. And I think like what I've realized personally and what I've realized from working with these volleyball players is like, if people are jumping a lot, it's pretty dang likely that they're going to have knee pain. So mm-hmm. it's about managing it. I think even more so than like preventing it necessarily. You could prevent it, but I think, you know, if I have an athlete for 6-8 weeks, like that's a hard period. I think if you were working with them for over a period of years and you were able to influence how much they're playing and all this stuff, you could do more. But to your question, I think you got to just assess the tolerance to it. So it's been kind of fortunate. One of the upsides of this, like this most recent period, is because of COVID, a lot of our athletes haven't been playing. So it's been kind of a nice window from a strength and conditioning standpoint. They're not getting all that stress on the court. So a couple girls, I felt like I was able to throw a lot of volume at them because they didn't have that normal volume. Now a lot of them are starting to play more, so I got to be more cognizant of it. But you got to see how they're responding to it. And for me, it's like if we do a workout and I have some jumping and some strength stuff in there, and then 2 days later they're in to train again or for treatment or whatever, and their pain levels are really like elevated. They were at a 2 out of 10, and now it's like a 4 or 5 out of 10. The stress we applied was too much. Their body wasn't able to adapt to it. If it's no worse, then I'm okay. I think we can kind of keep going with it again, because like I said, I mean, a lot of them are gonna have some knee pain. Like for me, honestly, like as long as it's not, if it doesn't get so bad to where it's impacting their performance, I think you can kind of, it's like yellow light, like proceed with caution. So I think you got to listen to the athlete there. And then did that answer the question?
Yeah, a little bit. More instead of like thinking like, I don't know if you're talking about like this is amount of like reps, how many jumps, okay, contacts you want to get, but it sounds like there's so much like freedom, or not freedom, but more so like just seeing how the athlete feels and kind of go from there.
Okay, I got you. So that's a good question. So I have seen a lot of recommendations about like how many ground contacts you should have in a week, how many like approach jumps you should do. I think the most recent thing I saw was like no more than like 30 approach jumps over a training week. When I program, I don't really ever count I'm not counting that stuff. I'm more so going just based on how the athlete feels. I do think that like, I think there's value with that, but I kind of start with, I'm going to start with like lower doses, and then I'm basically, if they're responding, their body is adapting to the stress I'm imposing, I can continue to increase the stress as I go, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that 30 number for approach jumps is probably, like if you're doing more approach jumping than that, like that's a pretty, you're going to have a hard time. Most athletes are not going to handle that amount of volume. I'll put it that way. In terms of ground contacts, like I would say I probably don't go above like 40 to 50 in a single session, but that's not counting like little like hopping or like more of those like extensive plyometrics, which is something that maybe we could talk about in regards to the ankle, but I've been doing a lot more of. So it's hard with these rules of thumb, and we've talked a lot about this too. Like one of the things that I've really come to realize just as I've like gained more experience and got a little bit older is when I was younger, I was like, I wanted to know like, well, what's the rule? How many ground contacts do you do in a week? And I think as a young coach or therapist, it's frustrating because you feel like you're just not like, I always felt like I wasn't, they just weren't like the coaches or therapists weren't like, they didn't want to give me the secret sauce. They didn't want to like tell me the magic answer, or like they didn't have it. They weren't very good. And what I've realized is it's not really out there. It doesn't exist, because it's going to be different for every single athlete. And that's what makes like a master clinician or master coach, is you have to be able to really get a good assessment of that athlete and how they're responding, and then that changes the dosage. So I've moved away from less like specifics and more towards just like directing it towards that athlete. And that's also a reflection of our circumstances. Like in the past, I've worked in groups with athletes, so it's much harder. We got to create kind of a general template that's going to fit most of them. in the clinic, I do a lot of one-on-one stuff. So I can make something, boom, this is the program for Liam. And I'm considering everything that's specific to you. So that the one-on-one is nice. I've really enjoyed that. Like, it definitely allows you to be more specific in terms of your dosing, your exercise selection, your progressions, all of that stuff.
Yeah, because I haven't, you know, I hear these people throw out these certain numbers, like, hey, for this like program, I'm only gonna have to jump this many times in a week or two. But, you know, I think the quality of the movement totally changes how many reps they can tolerate. Like, if they're jumping with, you know, maybe they get tired in the last few reps, their knee just drives so far forward, that's totally gonna bring that number down, how many they can tolerate. I wanna bring up too how you had a case study, I'm pretty sure, where you noticed this person was jumping with maybe their knee was coming a little farther forward with certain jumping or just her mechanics, where you think possibly that could have caused more stress on her knee too. Do you want to dive in on that a little bit?
Yeah. So, so we had a girl, she's right-handed. So she's hitting from the left side of the court in volleyball. So if you can picture it, the volleyball approach is four steps. So for her, it's basically right, left, right, left. So those last two, just think about those last two. It's like you're stepping into a jump. So you're going to plant right foot, big step forward, left leg is going to come next to it. So you're kind of in like a half squat. Then you're going to jump off of those. So what it looks like, and all of this I've learned from, I've never played volleyball a day in my life. So and I'm not a coach, but I've watched the athletes in here. So I can kind of see what they're looking like. And like, I just went on YouTube and looked up all the best. For me, I just looked at women's college volleyball and tried to see what the patterns they were. And what you normally see is right, left, big push off that left into the right. So that's what we call the penultimate step. So real aggressive push. They're trying to gain ground forward. Right foot hits and that's their break. So that stops that forward momentum. Boom, they plant that right foot on the ground. The heel hits the ground. So these are some of those biomechanic truths. That heel hits and you want that heel because it's breaking force. Because I just jumped forward basically and I don't want to hit the net. Then that left leg comes in next to it. So I'm kind of in an angled quarter squat position. Or half squat, we'll say. A good, powerful position from there, boom, I can push and jump up. With this girl, what was really interesting, and she's going to go play Division I college volleyball, like one of the better outside hitters in the state. She's not overly tall for her position, so she's a really good jumper. She can get up there. But what we noticed with her is she wasn't coming a few things. So when she was going into her penultimate, so left to right, that push, she wasn't making heel contact. She was on the ball of her foot. And I felt like what that was causing her to do was twofold, not push off that left foot because her body could intuitively sense that she wouldn't be able to slow down that momentum. It's like, if you know your brakes are broken on your car, you're not flooring that thing because you know you're going to be in trouble. The second thing with that too, is I also felt like it was because she wasn't getting that heel down, she wasn't taking as big a step. She wasn't pushing as hard off the left. And she was also not stopping her momentum as well. So what was happening with this girl is instead of coming into kind of an angled half squat position, she was almost getting into more of like a lunge position. So instead of that left leg gathering next to her to where both knees are kind of bent to similar flexion. And I know this is hard like over to visualize. But basically, instead of getting to a quarter squat and jumping from there, she was getting almost to like a split squat or like lunge position where her right knee, she'd rolled through that and now she was bent primarily on the left. It was almost like she was doing a single leg jump off the left. Well, she had really bad patellotendinitis. Guess which knee? Left knee. So I'm speculating here, but I think it totally makes sense. Like just over time, because of that jump pattern, she was overloading that left knee because she was basically doing a, like, if you can imagine a split squat where your left leg's forward and your left knee's forward and you're like 75% of the weight on the left, and then you jump up versus me or whoever, I'm in a half squat position and I'm jumping off of both legs. She was using more of that left leg. So, and that's where it became hard too because she's already really good at her sport skills. She's been jumping that for a long time. So we weren't able to be honest with you, I didn't feel like we changed those mechanics as much as I really wanted to. I also was kind of hesitant to really change her because to me, that's something I told her. I was like, you got to talk with your sport coaches because you already hit good like this. I'm not trying to screw you up. If you're a baseball pitcher and you throw 95 miles an hour and get people out and you have, quote, bad mechanics, like, are they really bad mechanics? Like, if they're allowing you to succeed at a high level, like, I would almost make the argument that maybe they're not bad mechanics. Mm-hmm. So I do think it contributed to her injury. We did a lot of different, like, jump drills to get her more comfortable jumping off too. I think there's more with her. She left to go to college now. I do think if she comes back in the winter and we're working more, we'll work more on that. But it's hard to change a pattern like that because you got to think like she's jumped that way so many, I mean, probably tens of thousands of reps mm-hmm. through her career. So yeah, that was an interesting one though, for sure. And we were able to get her heel striking more. And what that did is she got a way bigger penultimate step. So she was able to carry a lot more horizontal velocity into her jump. And she went from like, so we trained for 8 weeks basically. So like 2 months, and she went from like a 16 inch approach jump, to a 26 inch approach jump by the end, which is like, and that's a legit like 10 inch improvement. It's not like an internet, like, if you can put 3-4 inches on someone's vertical, like that's pretty solid. So for her to gain that jump, and like I said, she was already a pretty high level player, was pretty cool. And that's a good case too. Like, again, I'm not trying to take credit. She has good genetics. She's an elite athlete. So like, she adapted to the training better. Like, those are atypical results, I would say.
Yeah, I thought that was an awesome case study, because it brought just what you touched on. Like, do you try to improve the tolerance of the tendon so it can just withstand more force, it doesn't hurt, or do you try to change the mechanics? But, you know, she's so successful right now that it's interesting.
Yeah.
Case there.
And she wasn't playing, so she was asymptomatic. That's the other thing. So she had, one of the other therapists in our clinic actually had treated her. And he kind of did, like, he gets all the credit. He had kind of rehabbed her out of the patellar tendonitis. And then I kind of took over once she was already asymptomatic. Because of COVID, she wasn't playing volleyball. And we got, like, we trained pretty aggressively with, like, pretty high volume. And we didn't really have any knee issues. So I think we did a good job, like, rehabbing her and then just improving her tissue tolerance.
Cool, man. Well, that's pretty much all the things that I wanted to hit. Is there anything you want to add?
Trying to think. I don't think, like, nothing specific. I just think, like, so when it comes to jumping, guys, like, takeaways for this. If you're going to work, if you're training athletes, so if you're dealing with someone who has injuries in jumping, you need to assess their jump technique, like have them actually jump it, especially if it's like a volleyball or basketball player, someone where they do it very frequently as part of their sport. Cause I think that can really help you as a therapist or even a strength coach, whatever you are, in understanding the stresses that they're going through. I also think too, that like kind of, like classification system of athletes we mentioned earlier, that can give you a really good idea of what type of stuff they might really benefit from. And if you see someone that like should be a more elastic athlete, but really struggles with those things, they're kind of, maybe they haven't been trained in a way that's optimal for their body or their mechanics. Or that tells me like they have good potential, they're just not there yet. So like if they have really poor RSI, or they don't do well with short ground contact plyos, or they haven't worked like partial range of motion stuff, you can kind of go down that rabbit hole with them. And then I think the last thing that I didn't touch on that I've been using a lot too, is I think a super simple, like, good bang for your buck assessment you can do with athletes is just looking at the ratio between their squat jump and their counter movement jump. Or not ratio, just the difference between the two. So on the squat jump, it's more a measure of force output, because you're eliminating the stretch shortening cycle. So someone that is really good at like storing and releasing energy, someone that's more elastic, they're going to typically struggle with that. Versus someone that's more force-based, has really high strength levels and just pushes, they're going to do better with that. So what you do is you measure their squat jump, then you measure their counter movement jump. Typically, you want to see between 10 to 20% difference between those two, counter movement jump being higher. So then if you know, if let's say there's less than that, let's say there's 3% difference, that person needs to work more on their stretch shortening cycle, because they're not getting, they should be jumping higher when they have that added and they're not. If it's a bigger difference than that, so someone's, let's say someone squat jumps 15 inches and then counter movement jump, they can jump 23 inches or some better number like that. They're probably very elastic. They are really good at using their stretch shortening cycle, but they're probably not very strong, at least not strong in that position for sure. So you might work a little bit more force stuff with them. So that's one thing, that a simple assessment that I found to be pretty valuable with it.
Cool.
So yeah, guys, hopefully that's some interesting content and some stuff that helps you guys when you're working with the jumpers. I personally like, the jump stuff is really, really cool to me. And I think there's a lot of like applications and carry over to sprinting too. So yeah.
Yeah, man. I think that like the My Jump really makes all this stuff so easy to do. So I highly recommend getting that.
The MyJump app is awesome, guys. You can create different profiles and it stores them there. So like data collection is all stored and recorded. You can do drop jumps. You can do RSI. You can do every type of jumping. There's even an asymmetry index I use. So you can do like left versus right. So for like ankle rehab or something like that. you can really get all that stuff in there.
Yeah, one thing we want to touch on too is we notice it's same with sprinters too, just how much ankle stiffness can really limit these movements of how fast you can sprint, but also jumping, because obviously you have this huge engine in your hips and your quads, you can produce so much force, but if your ankles just have that weak link in the chain where you try to push that force and it just collapses and it can't deliver that force, and you're just going to miss out on so much energy.
Dude, that's a great point. And the analogy you just said, like, you have this huge engine, but you can't transfer that energy. Like, that, I love that. That makes so much sense to me. And I think for both of us, but this is something I didn't pay a lot of attention to in the past. I'm doing way more of what I've been doing lately that I love is I'll have athletes do, like, I guess you'd call them, like, extensive plyos, or, like, just sequences of, like, short, quick, like, a lot of times, like, single leg hops, where all we're trying to do is not, we're not trying to get height necessarily, but just pop, pop really rapid. And I'll do them in like a bunch of planes, like all this stuff. I think that's like, one, it's really good warm up. You get good blood flow going, get those tissues, the tendons hot, get everything moving. Two, I also think it's like, it's great for improving ankle stiffness and strength. And I also think too, like, you can do them really quick and it's good neural activation. Like, it's good CNS primer before the workout. So I think that's something too. If you guys aren't doing that with your, in your workouts, and they don't even like, with a wide receiver, someone that maybe like jumping isn't a core of their sport, having them do like some pogo hops, or like I've been loving the slant board in here. We have like an oversized calf stretching like slant board, and I'll have them do you can really do anything, but like I'll do like a single leg hop forward and back, and the slant board's cool because it makes them stay on the ball of their foot. They're not going to let that heel compress. So yeah, that's a big one, and that can make a big difference, just learning to use the ankle and create that stiffness in their sprinting speed, and definitely mm-hmm. Definitely in their jumping as well. And that's what's cool about that too, is it's pretty cool. You can change that much quicker because it's a skill. Like, when you test that RSI and people got to understand, okay, I got to anticipate the ground, boom, pop the ground, get as high as I can, as quick as I can. There's a big skill component to that. And you can improve that rapidly, like probably even more rapidly than you could someone's like strength or power. So a lot of these, like all these athletes I've worked with, like no one has ever talked to them about that. So they all suck at it when we start, and then they get like really good at it. And I think that's even more important, maybe. I would argue that might be the most important test for sports, because what's different about sports than a standing vertical? Time. In a standing vertical, I can load up as long as I want. I go when I want to go. When I'm playing any type of sport, I'm always reacting to a stimulus. I'm never just dictating it on my own terms. So those athletes, and like they talked, you probably saw this in triphasic training with that graph about the bench pressers. It's not, great athletes are not those who can produce the most force. It's who produces the highest force in the period given, right? So if I'm swinging a baseball bat, I only have whatever, 0.2 seconds. So I might be really, really strong on a bench press, but it's how much of that force can I express there? So, and the ankle is how you get that for mm-hmm. sure. So if you're not doing extensive plyos or ankle stiffness stuff, mm-hmm. make sure you do that with your jumpers for sure.
Yeah, man. I've with the football guys I've been working with, just recording like the start, like the first 0-10 yards, just seeing when they deliver that punch into the ground, see that ankle collapse, like just imagine when they're cutting on the field and they go to cut. If you're an efficient cutter, that's a strong cut. And if that ankle can't hang with it, then you're not going to be as effective.
And I think about this too, for like, we're physios, like for injury prevention. So if you can't handle, let's say that cut is 300 newtons of force. I have no idea what it actually is, but it's arbitrary number. And let's say normally 50 newtons is dissipated or like controlled or produced, whatever term you want to use, at the ankle. If you don't have that, you have two options. Now your cut has way less force, so it's slow and it sucks. So this athlete isn't getting a scholarship. They're not playing professional sports. Or, and I think you see this a ton, that stress has to go somewhere else. Boom, what's the next like joint by joint approach? What's the next joint? That knee. And I think like with non-contact ACL and stuff, mm-hmm. I really think there's a lot to the ankle being able to absorb. Because if you can't absorb 50 at the ankle, mm-hmm. it's got to go somewhere, either the hip or the knee. Mm-hmm. Or the other option is their cuts aren't very fast and explosive, and that's mm-hmm. not a good option either.
Dude, that'd be interesting to take some like RSIs, at least test the counter movement and the squat jump, just taking that alone and then seeing, you know, how the season goes, if they have any ACL stuff going on there.
Yeah, and I think definitely like I think the RSI and like a single leg RSI would be a good return to sport test. Because remember what, like way back maybe like 5 or 6 episodes ago, we talked about how strength levels got there, but it was the rate of force development. So the RSI is awesome because it's like, now you're looking at rate of force, like that's the highest rate of force mm-hmm. development that you can have. And because we know with ACLs, there's so much like proprioception and like neuromuscular stuff in terms of their coordination. Mm-hmm. Again, it's kind of like we said that RSI is also like a little bit of a learned skill. So I think that's a good like I think that's a good return to sport test that people could be using.
Yeah.
It'd also be interesting to get if we had RSI data from like Combine too, to see, like, I would love to see like what Barry Sanders, like if he had like crazy high RSI, and mm-hmm. we could correlate that between like his like change of direction ability.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
we're getting on a tangent now, but hopefully you guys got some good takeaways from that. It's a topic I think both Liam and I have been pretty passionate about and seen some pretty good stuff with athletes. So check that out. Hit us up if you guys have any questions. And if you haven't given us a rate and review, make sure to do that.